Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Virtually every recent conversation, every legal case surrounding the issue of child migrants held in U.S. government detention has focused on the 1997 Flores Agreement. That's the settlement that requires children to be held in humane conditions and for no longer than 20 days. Well, tomorrow, the Trump administration is set to publish new rules that eliminate the Flores Agreement. The administration argues that it allows families to be kept together while in detention and that it will deter migrants from trying to cross the southern border. Critics say the move will lead to the indefinite detention of children and their families in facilities that are already having extreme difficulty coping with and caring for the number of families in detention. So this hour on Point, migrant children in U.S. detention and major changes to the Flores Agreement. And you can join us. What is your take on the proposed changes? What do you think when you hear families could be detained indefinitely? Do you think it will serve as a deterrent? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll begin today in Washington with Molly O'Toole. She's immigration reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Molly, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, it seems as if the Trump administration has been talking about wanting to make changes to Flores for some time now, at least ever since late last year. What's the significance of them making this move now?
Absolutely. Since really early on in the Trump administration, since early 2017, you can see this sort of increasing rhetoric and increasing attention given to the Flores Agreement. The Trump administration has long argued that it is a quote-unquote legal loophole, and they also argue that it is one of the main drivers, if not the main driver, of Central American families coming to the border because of an understanding that children and families will likely be released. And the significance of this move now, so last year they actually released the proposed rules, and almost immediately the lawyers who were part of the original Flores case, the original Flores settlement, filed against the proposed rules, which now, a year later, those rules will sort of formally be published tomorrow. That's what the acting Homeland Security Secretary announced. And that would mean that in 60 days, although the implementation would likely take longer, that's what McAleenan suggested, in 60 days, those rules would go into effect, and they essentially terminate the terms of the Flores Agreement from 1997 that was also strengthened in 2015, the agreement saying essentially that the government needs to release children as soon as possible within 20 days is sort of the limit that's been formalized. And that goes for children who are traveling on their own to the border, and that also goes for children who are traveling with families.
Right. So there's a lot to dig into here. First of all, let's listen to Acting Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan, who you just mentioned. And this is part of what he said when he announced the policy or the move yesterday.
The new rule establishes a high national standard for care of children and families in custody, allows the government to keep families together for fair and expeditious immigration proceedings, restores integrity to our immigration system, and eliminates the incentive for children to be used or exploited to enter the United States.
That's Kevin McAleenan, acting DHS secretary. Molly, I want to dissect a little bit of what he just said here. First of all, what about the part of the Trump administration sees eliminating Flores as the way by which the government will be able to keep families together for fair and expeditious immigration proceedings? I mean, are any immigration proceedings happening within a 20-day window as it is? I mean, how much more expeditious are they going to be able to get?
Well, that's a really key question because there are many factors that are contributing to an extreme backlog in immigration cases that's actually gotten even worse under the Trump administration. And so this is sort of just speaking of immigration cases more broadly, but they're almost over 900,000 pending immigration cases, and they take an average of 2 years. Now, for detained cases, in which a family is detained, those tend to move more quickly. They're considered priority cases. But part of the problems that the Homeland Security has been having, they've been, you know, the conditions that we saw, particularly over the summer, that got a lot of public attention in these temporary holding facilities, you know, they say that those conditions were due to these overcrowding problems because essentially these cases can't be processed quickly enough. These people can't be processed quickly enough. So it's hard to see how they're going to be able to get to this to a 20-day number when clearly there have been struggles for quite a long time that predate the Trump administration in processing these cases quickly. Now, McLean points to an average of about 50 days in custody for these families that dates to around 2015 before the strengthening of the rule. But that other advocates suggest that's a little misleading because many families were simply giving up their asylum cases rather than continuing to go forward because of their experience in detention, you know, skewing that number a little bit. And there are many factors that contribute to this being a very different situation in 2019 right. than it was in 2015.
Okay, so what about the part where McLean says the new rule establishes a high national standard of care for children? Because I think people might remember that it wasn't that long ago that members of the Justice Department were arguing in federal court against Flores, saying the government didn't even need to provide toothbrushes for children currently in detention.
Exactly. And actually, that ruling just came down last week that said that the government has to provide toothbrushes and soap to children that are in U.S. custody, to migrant children in U.S. custody. And the Trump administration was arguing against that. So I think there is a reasonable question whether can the government be trusted, entrusted with the power potentially to indefinitely detain families and to do so humanely, given that we have many examples. They have a very mixed record when it comes to providing even the required standards of care for children. So that's a really good example, the case last week. So now McLean suggests that they're going to use the same standards of care that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, as most people know it, which is another DHS agency that handles long-term detention, generally speaking. He says they're going to bring it in line with the same standards that ICE has for single adults in detention. And that does involve, you know, access to education, access to exercise. Those are what the standards are supposed to be. But the very nature of the Flores settlement is that the government has not always met those standards. And we have very recent examples, such as the ones that you pointed to, in which they were falling short.
Mm. And in a little while, we will talk about how even in the Obama administration, there were attempts to circumvent Flores. And we'll get to that. But Molly, stand by here for just a second, because I want to introduce into the conversation Senator Jeff Merkley. He joins us from New York. He's a Democratic senator from Oregon, author of the new book, America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. Now, in 2018, Senator Merkley tried to enter the Casa Padre processing facility in Brownsville, Texas. He was turned away by border officials or officials at that facility. We'll hear a little bit more about that in a moment. But Senator Merkley, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
So I'm going to guess that you are not thrilled by the Trump administration deciding to move forward with new rules that would essentially eliminate the Flores Agreement.
Not at all. For our government to try to strike down basic humane standards for the treatment of children says a lot. This is the same government that said we're going to stop letting the children outside to play soccer. This is the same government that recently said we're not going to give flu vaccines, even though three refugee children have died of flu. And in the conditions in a CBP holding center, flu can move very quickly through a crowd. The same government that said we don't want to be held to providing soap and mattress. This is the same government that said we're going to let these kids sleep on these very cold, ice-cold concrete floors in holding cells and leave the lights on all night. So, no, absolutely, I do not trust them. They have been trying to do this since June of 2017. The president held a press conference to say he was ending the child separation because he'd been moved by the stories from his wife, the First Lady, and his daughter. And that was not accurate. The court had shut the front door on child separations. The administration has pried a back door open and continued to separate children from their parents without a standard or cause that would justify that under American law. And then they have proceeded to pursue three ways of striking down Flores. One was to go back to the court.
Yeah, I'm so sorry, Senator. I'm going to hear those three ways from you in just a second here. But because you talked about the family separation, I just want to, I mean, I want to point out that the administration would say and does say that because of Flores, because they're not allowed to detain children for more than 20 days, that that is one of the reasons why families end up getting separated. And you just heard Kevin McAleenan in that piece of tape saying eliminating Flores would allow the government to keep families together.
14 days into this administration, their first official spoke to this. They said that we're pursuing child separation because it deters refugees from coming. It was about inflicting trauma on children to discourage refugees from considering America. And then it was just shortly after that that John Kelly came out the following month, and he described the same thing, deterrence stemming from this is the way we're going to treat children. And so their motivation has been to use the poor treatment, trauma against children, as a political weapon. And this is just not acceptable under any moral code, any religious tradition. It's horrific. It's manifested itself in many ways, including things before the children get into the United States. For example, the border blockade, where children are left to fend for themselves without family, without funds, without friends, in very dangerous cities in Mexico.
So, Senator Merkley, we have to take a break here in about 30 seconds, but I want to ask you, do you equate what the administration is trying to do with Flores as perhaps leading to, I think you've used this word before, to internment of families?
Yes. The camps would resemble internment camps. This is the way that Senator Hirono has described them. Others have described them this way because it's basically like World War II, like locking up Japanese-American families for years. This would be locking up Mexican-American but Mexican families, refugee families for years. These proceedings can go on for years.
And Central American families, mostly, who are crossing the border now. But Senator Merkley and Molly O'Toole with the Los Angeles Times, stand by here for a second. We are talking about the Trump's administration's decision tomorrow to publish new rules that essentially eliminate the Flores Agreement and that could lead to the government detaining migrant families indefinitely. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the Flores Agreement. That is the 1997 settlement that determined that the United States government cannot detain migrant children for more than 20 days. Well, the Trump administration tomorrow is set to publish new rules that would effectively eliminate the Flores Agreement. They say it will allow them to keep migrant families together as they await immigration processing. But critics are deeply concerned that it could lead to the indefinite detention of migrant families. And we want to hear from you. What's your reaction to this latest move on immigration from the Trump administration? I'm joined today by Molly O'Toole. She's an immigration reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Senator Jeff Merkley also joins us. He's a Democratic senator from Oregon, author of America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. In a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from an analyst who thinks that the Trump administration is making the right move. But let's get a quick call here. Jennifer is calling from Evansville, Indiana. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi. I find the situation, we hate what we're doing with the families. But we need to keep in mind, and this is my personal opinion, these people have left a bad situation. And they've traveled hard ways. Sometimes children were sent alone in the past. Taking care of these people became a very, very large event for us. And I think that giving them what we have been able to do is far better than what they left. It isn't what we want for any of them. But I think our government owes the citizens of this country the responsibility of vetting these people. And it does take time because there are so many. So I think we just need to keep the practical situation in mind and realize there's no good way. And for us to want to give them what we already have, they're not citizens yet, but we are giving them shelter. We are doing the best that we can. And to expect that we're going to give them better than they had what they left automatically is I think it's not being realistic.
Right. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. So, Senator Merkley, how would you respond to Jennifer?
Well, when people come here fleeing persecution, it's tapping into a deep tradition in the United States of America of treating people with respect and dignity. That is what Lady Liberty's torch is all about. We can treat people with respect and dignity and still have a very competent asylum process where people have the burden of proof of demonstrating that they have a credible fear of return. And we've had a very good program called the Family Case Management Program that ensured that people, that even though they weren't in prison, they did show up for their hearings and they did show up for their check-ins. The Trump administration eliminated this program, which, by the way, cost about a 20th of the cost of imprisoning people. The big issue here is that the Trump administration is deliberately inflicting trauma on refugees as a strategy to deter immigration. It's a flawed approach. It does not lead to deterrence because when people are told this Friday, if you don't pay us extortion money, we kill you, they flee. And it's hard to establish that under an asylum process, and most people are turned down and returned to their countries. But let's treat people with dignity and respect.
Well, I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is Brandon Judd. He's president of the National Border Patrol Council, a labor union that represents agents and staff on the U.S. Border Patrol. And Brandon Judd spoke to Fox News yesterday about the proposed changes regarding the Flores Agreement. He was asked whether he thought facilities would run out of room if migrants' families now and children, along with their families, were held for more than 20 days. Here's how Judd responded.
No, I don't. And the reason is because the word will get back to these countries immediately and the numbers will drop exponentially. All we have to do is look at the migrant protection protocol. In 3 short months, our apprehensions at the end of this month will be about 100,000 less than what they were in May. And so you can see the immediate effect that we have when we implement proper policies, and this will do the same.
Molly O'Toole, help us understand this a little here, because Judge just said that they have seen a drop in apprehensions here. So are these changes, which, you know, again, critics see as very heartless, but are they effective in reducing the number of people trying to cross the border?
It's really difficult to know. You know, this is the central argument that the Trump administration is making for ending the Flores Agreement, that it will act as a deterrent. Word will get back, and thus these families and these children will stop coming. But we should note that since 1994, which is, I believe, the first time that Border Patrol actually formalized a national border security strategy, since 1994, the primary policy of both Democratic and Republican administrations has been deterrence. So clearly, if we if the administration wants to measure its success on immigration and border security by number of apprehensions at the border, which is how they tend to measure it. Since 1994, there have been massive spikes. And in the early 2000s, we had over a million routinely from the 80s to about the mid-2000s. And then we had a drop and this increase again under the Trump administration. So clearly the deterrence, I think it's safe to say, has not worked as a strategy. And suggesting that ending Flores is going to have a dramatic impact, it's hard to say. But it also ignores, if you see Flores as a pull factor, which the administration clearly does, it also ignores the push factors from Central America. I mean, the very origin of the Flores agreement was the Salvadoran Civil War in the 80s that was forcing people to flee El Salvador and come to the United States. And in the unaccompanied minors crisis in 2014 through 2016, roughly, in which the Obama administration was trying to detain families together for longer periods of time, that also was closely tied to push factors from Central America, where we see homicide rates that are among the highest in the world, particularly from the Northern Triangle. So this is the argument that the administration makes, but it's hard to say whether this is going to have the dramatic impact that they say that it will, because deterrence clearly has not been an effective strategy.
So, Senator Merkley, I'm going to come back to you for a second, but Molly, we should talk about what you just said, that, look, in the 2014-2015, the Obama administration also wanted to try argued that it needed to detain families for longer periods of time, but they couldn't get that passed in court. And that's, in fact, what ended up strengthening the Flores Agreement. So, I mean, I guess the point is what significantly is the Trump administration doing that's different than what the Obama administration tried to do before?
I think that's also important to note that the Obama administration also struggled to respond to the unaccompanied minors crisis. The Obama administration also tried to detain families together, but we did not see the conditions in detention under the Obama administration that we have seen under the Trump administration. The Obama administration, while trying to detain families together, for example, was not trying to take away, you know, soap and toothbrushes from children. So I think we also should note that the administration is sort of trying to have it both ways here. They're saying they have to have this because there's been this really dramatic increase in Central American families, which is true. But at the same time, they're touting their policies, their deterrence policies of having worked. So why is necessarily terminating the Flores Agreement necessary, given that DHS officials have said that this overcrowding crisis that led to these poor conditions for children and families in detention is essentially over? Because there's been, while numbers are still very high, there's been a 50% decrease from May to July, specifically in unaccompanied minors and families coming to the border. And so they suggest that they, you know, that overcrowding is done. So I think there are also questions as to why this is necessary.
Hmm. Senator Merkley, is it possible that this is going to certainly immediately come up against legal challenges? I'm seeing, you know, Peter Shea, the lawyer who originally helped achieve the Flores Agreement. He says that if the new regulations don't match what's in the current settlement, he says it'll be an immediate material breach, if not contempt of court. So this might not be implemented for quite some time. But nevertheless, I want to ask you, Senator, are you concerned that if it is implemented, there may be monitoring opportunities or oversight opportunities that are lost? Because I understand that a lot of the lawyers who have been able to get into these detention centers are doing so via the Flores Agreement.
No, that's absolutely right. And what the administration wants to do with this regulation is to eliminate the requirement for state licensing and state oversight. That means we're trusting this administration, which has routinely dehumanized immigrants, has routinely sought to inflict pain on immigrants and immigrant children. And they're saying, trust us, we'll do the job. But under their theory of deterrence, the more pain they inflict, the more deterrence there is. That has been constant throughout this administration. Let me note that in Flores, it says that if there is a regulation or law that implements Flores, then Flores will go away, and I think it's after 45 days. This does not implement FLORAs. This crushes FLORAs. This gets rid of the requirements for rapid movement of children into the least restrictive setting possible. It strikes down the state supervision and the state licensing. This is, if you want to describe this in a phrase, this new regulation is a child imprisonment regulation. And that is why I'm so determined that it not stand. And it will not stand. I agree with Peter Shea. The courts will look and say, this doesn't implement FLORAs. This crushes FLORAs. Therefore, it is not valid under the clause of the settlement agreement.
Well, I want to bring into the conversation now Mike Howell. He joins us from Cambridge, Maryland. He's a senior advisor for the executive branch relations at the Heritage Foundation. And from 2017 to 2018, he was with the Department of Homeland Security as oversight counsel, handling congressional inquiries and associated legal issues. Mike Howell, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
So what's your take on the administration's move to eliminate FLORAs? Do you think it's the right thing to do?
Oh, absolutely, and it's in line with exactly what the Obama administration tried to do, and I'll note that you weren't hearing the same outcry from the senator and others at that time. And if I may, I'd like to do some cleanup on a couple topics that were just raised. On the topic of toothpaste and soap, this is largely a fake news story that has been propagated throughout the media and, unfortunately, through some of the highest officials in the land. On a recent congressional delegation to the southern border that Mark Morgan took 13 Democratic senators on, he took them to a room which was absolutely full from floor to ceiling of juice boxes, soap, toothpaste, feminine hygiene products, etc. Yet, even after seeing this, Democrat senators proceeded to hold a press conference saying that these, you know, things were not available to people. There was a story in which they asked a 7-year-old whether he had brushed his teeth. The 7-year-old, who didn't speak English, hadn't brushed his teeth that day, said so much, but the senators took that to mean no kids are brushing their teeth.
Well, so Mike, let me just jump in here, though. You're not disputing the fact that DOJ lawyer Sarah Howell argued in court that the administration doesn't need to provide toothpaste, soap, etc. That happened in a federal court. It's on camera.
Right, and I'm telling you that all these facilities have toothpaste and soap, and what I would encourage reporters to actually do is go out there and report, and if they believe that the Trump administration is denying these basic amenities, it would take some basic reporting to go to these facilities and actually find one that did not have toothpaste.
Okay, so hang on. We have a reporter here, Molly O'Toole.
Hello.
Go ahead. Your response to what Mike Howell is saying? I don't necessarily want this conversation to be derailed by toothpaste and soap, but fact-check this. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, so there's the ruling last week in which a federal appeals court said the government had to produce toothpaste and soap. So clearly the Trump administration was trying not to provide those things, to get out of those requirements to children. And that's sort of an undeniable reality. There's also the case that we had a panel of lawyers and outside panel of lawyers who are supposed to be monitoring conditions under FLORAs that went to some of these facilities and found that conditions were substandard. And the government was not disputing that, actually. The government was saying, this is why we need emergency funding, because we are having an overcrowding problem in these facilities. So certainly there will be circumstances in which whoever will be visiting these facilities and certain facilities will see that those things are being provided. But we have clear evidence and documentation of the government attempting to get out of some of those requirements. And then also that conditions at some of these facilities have been substandard. So there has been a lot of reporting on this. There have been a lot of outside experts that have documented this, in addition to the fact that access to these facilities tends to be extremely restricted. So I appreciate the suggestion that all reporters should go out and visit these facilities. And I think that they would welcome that opportunity.
Right. Well, I mean, Senator Merkley himself tried to get into a facility last year and was turned away here. I want to correct a mistake that I made here. First of all, I said that Sarah Howell was the DOJ immigration lawyer. That's wrong. I meant to say Sarah Fabian. Mike Howell is our guest who joins us today. And Mike, let me just get you to answer. I'd love to hear your answer to the question about why you think eliminating FLORAs. Let's just focus on that. Why do you think it's the right thing to do?
Right, because under the FLORAs, you know, regime, which was basically the unilateral decision of a judge out in California that controlled immigration policy for the entire country, the administration is faced with the impossible task of, you know, controlling a flood of individuals and family units across the border. They basically have to release anyone with a child into the interior after 20 days. We know that the vast majority of those people do not show up for their hearings. There's statistics all over the map on this that are largely cherry-picked to fit whatever narrative. But the fact is that people do not show up for their hearings once they are in the interior.
I thought the fact was exactly the opposite, that especially those folks who have lawyers, 99% of them show up for their hearings.
No. See, it gets muddied once you start putting in the who shows up for their final hearing and what subsets of, you know, people you look at. But as the White House said when they rolled this out, that 80% of family units in a recent time frame covering the last couple of fiscal years haven't showed up for their hearings. And you can look at the removal statistics. We aren't removing family units from the interior. So the point of the matter is that if you get released into the interior, you're not going back right now. So what the open borders advocates on the left and their allies in the media are essentially saying is that people need to be released into the interior, you know, to never be removed again. That is de facto open borders. I personally wish the conversation could move to a more open place where those, you know, advocates could say that is their end goal, just a open border system in which people are released into the interior.
Okay, so Mike, since we have Senator Jeff Merkley here right now, I want to turn back to him. There's lots of numbers here. I'm seeing that a Syracuse University analysis of Justice Department data shows that 86% of people released from custody show up to their initial hearings, even without a lawyer. But Senator Merkley, I mean, Mike Howell is talking about people like you when he says open border advocates. What do you think?
Well, the Democrats in the Senate supported a comprehensive immigration bill that provided security at the border, security for folks overstaying their visas, which is actually the majority of folks who are here undocumented, provided security at the point of employment. It was the Republicans in the House that torpedoed the bipartisan Senate bill that passed with an overwhelming majority. And in terms of people showing up for their hearings, we didn't hear Mr. Howell speak to the fact that it was the Trump Inspector General of Homeland Security that did two different reports, two comprehensive studies, and found that if there is a case manager, 99% of the people show up at their hearings. It is the Trump administration that canceled this program that is completely setting the stage for their argument. They're creating the crisis they now complain about.
Senator Merkley, Mike Howell, and Molly O'Toole, stand by. Quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunha was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the Trump administration's move to issue new regulations that could eliminate the so-called Flores Agreement. This is the 1997 legal agreement that made it impossible for the U.S. government to detain migrant children for more than 20 days. The Trump administration says it wants to eliminate the agreement so that it can hold migrant families together. That's what Kevin McAleenan, the acting Homeland Security Secretary, says, for fair and expeditious immigration proceedings. But critics see the move as opening the door to the possibility of migrant families being held in detention in the United States indefinitely. I'm joined today by Molly O'Toole. She's immigration reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Senator Jeff Merkley joins us. He's a Democratic senator from Oregon and author of America is Better Than This, Trump's War Against Migrant Families. And Mike Howell is also with us. He's a senior advisor for executive branch relations at the Heritage Foundation. And Mike Howell, if I may, there's something that the acting DHS secretary said that I want to hear a little bit more from you. You know, when Kevin McAleenan talked about keeping families together to hold fair and expeditious immigration proceedings. Now, we heard Molly O'Toole a little earlier describe how part of the problem is that there's such a huge glut of cases right now and not enough, you know, immigration judges or means by which to have these proceedings, that it is possible that families may end up being detained for much longer than the 50 days that McAleenan says. I mean, critics say it could be indefinitely. It could be for years. Would you like to see a beefing up of the immigration infrastructure to help make these processes more efficient?
Oh, absolutely, and that should be a completely bipartisan issue. The backlog in the immigration court system is way too long, and there's a lot we can do to empower immigration judges to process claims more quickly, such as giving them, you know, summary judgment authority for, you know, facially fraudulent claims. They should be able to hold bad lawyers in contempt. Right now they can't, and there's a lot of pervasive fraud in this industry. At Heritage, we issued a report, an agenda for American immigration reform, where we kind of go through specific actions to beef it up. But at the end of the day, it's a funding issue. We need more judges. We need more caseworkers. And we're going to need a lot more funding for these facilities. Right now, the capacity of DHS, once this is all rolled out, to actually hold people in these very high-standard facilities is very low. Last year, we had, almost 500,000 family unit individuals come in, and the facilities can only hold a very small fraction of those. So at the end of the day, it should be a bipartisan concern that if we are going to house people in these facilities, let's fund them, let's build them, let's make sure there's enough of them, and we can process their claims as fast as possible. It should be a team effort there.
Senator Merkley, would you like to respond to that?
Well, we do have a system to dismiss facially fraudulent claims. It's called a credible fear interview, and that's the first stage in the process. I support the notion of having timely asylum hearing process. It has to be enough time to get the documentation. Remember, the burden of proof is on the refugee. That means they have to have legal representation. For these children who come into the system, if they had a caseworker and they had an attorney or a legal assistant from the very beginning, it would greatly expedite the process, but they have to be able to have the chance to represent themselves fairly, to be able to obtain the documentation from the country they're fleeing from. Otherwise, it is an unfair process.
Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Dave, you're on the air.
Thank you. How are you guys doing today?
Very well,
Dave. I cut past it. What I wanted to say is I have kind of an observation and a question. The observation is, this doesn't really make sense to me. And so with everything else that the Trump administration is dealing with, this comes to the question, why this and why now? He usually does this kind of stuff to wrap up get his base all wound up and get going in support of something. And this is the thing I'm worried, I can't help but think about, is what doesn't he want us looking at? What is he trying to dissuade us away from so that we don't pay attention to it? I'm going to hang up and let you guys answer that. It just strikes me as being weird timing. So,
well, Dave, thanks for that call. Molly O'Toole, do you have any insight on that?
I have no insight into what's going on in the president's mind and necessarily what he might be trying to distract us from. I mean, I don't necessarily think that this move is a distraction. I think this has been a long-held goal by the Trump administration that they have been trying to do. I mean, clearly there are a lot of things going on right now. There's some economic indicators that are not necessarily favorable to the president. But in the immigration space, which is what I focus on, this is a significant move. I don't think it's a distraction in and of itself. It's something they've been trying to do for a long time, although we should see it as an escalation, yes, but as part of a broader pattern in which the Trump administration has been absolutely explicit that they are going to try and restrict immigration to the United States, both legal and illegal. I mean, recently we had the changes in a very similar mechanism as the one we're seeing here, the announced changes to a public charge rule that would essentially restrict immigrants, but also immigrant families of immigrants and non-immigrants from accessing certain benefits, which widely is analyzed to suggest that to essentially punish immigrants in the United States who are here legally. So this is part of that, clearly part of that that effort.
Mike Howell, I want to ask you another question here. There is every possibility that in some of these cases, if Flores is essentially crushed, as the administration might put it, there is a possibility that families might be held in U.S. detention with young children for months or even years. So kids in detention for years by the U.S. government. Does that trouble you at all?
No, it does not, because if you read the Flores regulation, the standard that we set for these facilities is very high. These are places with indoor-outdoor rec, Xboxes, PlayStation, snacks all day. They're basically very nice dormitories And if it is, as you know, Senator Merkley said, that these folks are fleeing persecution, I think that's a very nice alternative. I will add that it is categorically false that all these people are fleeing persecution. It is an economic migrant surge. These are people coming to America for the access to, you know, better economic opportunities, and that is very different from the asylum claim. A lot of these people are coming from places that are a lot safer than places in the U.S., like Baltimore.
Senator, would you like to respond?
I think about this mother and daughter who I visited in held in Dilley, which is an internment camp in Texas. And because of the complexity of their case, they had been held for 5 months. The daughter wasn't eating. She wasn't sleeping. She was suicidal. And because there is an enormous impact of being incarcerated. You can have snacks all day. That doesn't stop the fact that you're in prison. Child experts have come forward who really understand these issues and have spoken to their very knowledgeable research in terms of the deep trauma that occurs from long-term imprisonment. You are separated from your peers. You have no sense of how you're going to fulfill your life. You have maybe only a single family member with you. It just goes on and on. We have to understand that if we're listening to the experts, imprisonment does deep damage to children. Internment camps do deep damage to children, and that is not being acknowledged by the administration.
Let's go to Bill, who's calling from New Orleans. Bill, you're on the air.
And I guess, you know, the recent comment used the word economic in it, and I think that's interesting because one aspect that I don't hear addressed with regard to the elimination of floors is that it's going to be a windfall for the private confinement industry in the U.S. that has been expanding substantially for the last 15 years. And I'd like to hear somebody say something about that.
Well, Bill, thank you for your call. Molly O'Toole, do you have any insight on this question?
It's very true that detention is expensive for the U.S. government. I think that's pretty undeniable. So whatever your political leanings might be, and I'm a reporter, the detention is very expensive, and releasing people into the United States, whether or not you're an advocate for that, is a much cheaper alternative for the U.S. government.
So, Mike Howell, one more.
Magna, can I jump in here for a second?
Sure, Senator. Then I do want to turn back to Mr. Howell, but go ahead, Senator.
Because to that point, the notorious prison is Homestead. Now, Homestead was set up with a no-compete contract. John Kelly is on the board of it. He was on the board of the company before he came into the administration. He's paid huge sums to be on the board. They had no incentive for children to be moved to a state-licensed facility or into homes. So they expanded to 3,200 children. They had a big concern over the possibility of a hurricane impact. They have now emptied it out, but they're promising to reopen it. But that is a deep corruption. No compete contract. $750 to $775 a day, no incentive to move those children out of that setting. And that is a setting where they do not required to have any form of standards because they're not state licensed.
Mike Howell, I think I heard you wanted to get in there a second or two ago, but did you have a comment?
Yeah, absolutely. On the idea that detention is expensive, Molly's absolutely correct. What we should do to make it less expensive is have less people come here in the first place and adjudicate their claims more quickly. But releasing them into the interior is not cheaper. The you know, life cycle cost of illegal immigration is very high. There are impacts on, you know, the economy of the U.S. There are impacts on our criminal justice system. There are impacts on all sorts of social service systems, you know, our schools, our hospitals, et cetera. So let's not pretend that release into the interior is somehow a cheap and good option for the U.S. It has its costs.
Well, Mike Howell, senior advisor for the executive branch relations, or I should say for executive branch relations at the Heritage Foundation. And from 2017 to 2018, he was with the Department of Homeland Security as oversight counsel, handling congressional inquiries and associated legal issues. Mike Howell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's go to Pablo, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Pablo, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I just wanted to comment that part of the issue here is fraudulent asylum claims are rampant because the opportunity of jobs in these states, and also because employers can create a substandard class of workers, whether they're legal under an asylum claim or illegal, and pay them less wages. To address the issue at the border, you have to start at the source. The source is where people coming to the United States can actually have wages. Now, imagine what you would do with $700 a day for every children at a school instead of an internment camp. Thank you.
Well, Pablo, thank you so much for your call. Senator Merkley, would you like to respond to him?
Well, we should talk about the fact of what is going on in Central America that is driving so much immigration. And what we have is a situation where drug cartels moved into that area, took control of it, of the Northern Triangle. They make their money where? From selling drugs in the United States of America. It is American money. Where do they get their guns? They come from the United States of America. It was the return of gang members to Central America from L.A. and other parts of the country in the 90s that established the street-level extortion. This is not mom-and-pop extortion. This is not, if you don't pay us, we will put a brick through your window. This is, if you don't pay us today, tomorrow we kill you, or worse yet, a family member of yours, or worse yet, we gang rape your daughter. The conditions are going to take an enormous amount of assistance in order for the government and the judicial system to reestablish control over those countries. And if control is not reestablished by the traditional institutions of justice, well, then people are going to keep fleeing. And so that is a question that is with us because we're spending billions and billions of dollars on the border. But maybe we should think about helping invest in the traditional system of justice and social welfare in Central America work more effectively.
Molly O'Toole, I'm seeing here that DHS officials are also saying this week that they don't have any immediate plans to increase the number of family detention beds. So if Flores is eliminated, essentially, and many more families are staying together for indefinite periods of time, what's going to happen?
It's a really good question. Right now, there are three family facilities across the United States, and one of them is being used for single adults, and the other two are at capacity. So there's actually no space right now for the families. Now, as I noted, we have had a 50% decrease in unaccompanied minor children and family units coming to the border since May, but numbers are still very high. The Department of Homeland Security says in terminating the Flores agreement, which would allow them to potentially indefinitely hold families, it's going to be such a deterrent that they're not going to need this extra space. Time will tell whether or not that will be true if these rules are allowed to go forward and the agreement is terminated. They're also asking for more funding for family detention and for more funding for ICE to increase the number of beds. And I think advocates' concern is that if you are giving them more beds, giving them more detention space, and then lifting the limits on how long families can be held, what incentive is there to process these families quickly?
So, Senator Merkley, in that case, I mean, it's children who were caught in the ultimate catch-22. I mean, if members of Congress such as yourself want more oversight before they give more money, and the Trump administration says we simply just need the more money, every single day, children are caught in the middle.
Funding has not been the issue for providing basic care to the children, and Congress, bipartisan basis, has provided that support. One of the pieces, though, that we haven't talked about of how children are affected is that there is a metering system. So the president said, don't cross between ports of entry. Come to the port of entry, and then you can proceed under basically a standard operating procedures. But then the families and the children came to the port of entry, and they were turned away. I watched the officers stand in the middle of the bridge down there in Hidalgo, Reynosa, and proceed to block the refugees from crossing the bridge. I attended the metering sessions in Tijuana where families were turned back. The father and daughter in that graphic picture in the New York Times who died swimming the river, they came to a port of entry. They asked for refugee status. They were thrown back into Mexico with no resources. That's why so many people cross between the ports of entry is they're rejected at the ports of entry. And the children in Tijuana, they were not even allowed to sign up on the list to be in the line to present their case. So they were permanently stranded in Tijuana. I visited with children who were there for months on the street, desperate, subject to a big sex industry.
Right. Senator, I'm so sorry to have to interrupt. We're just flat out of time. Senator Jeff Merkley and Molly O'Toole, thanks both to both of you. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.